My name is Travis Benanti from the Penn State NAC Center. Today we're talking about ESIDE 215. The title of this unit is Organic Solar Cells. Here's an outline of the unit. First, we're going to talk about an introduction to solar energy conversion. Then we'll take a look at an overview of the technology and materials associated with organic solar cells. Next, we'll look at an example of a processing sequence in order to fabricate lab-scale organic solar cells. And then we'll talk about the characterization of these devices and finish up with processing trends for the future regarding organic solar cells. So if we look at the global energy demand, there's often this term that's used, which is called terawatt challenge. So what we have to think about is how big is a terawatt and how big is the global demand for energy? Well, a terawatt actually is 10 raised to the 12th power of watts. So that's an extremely large number. And we can keep this prefix tera in our minds by thinking about some other common prefixes. So we have mega, which is 10 to the 6th. We have giga, 10 to the 9th. And then above that, by another factor of 1,000, is tera. So 10 to the 12th. That's a really large number. And let's look at this quote down here from Professor Smalley, who is a famous professor at Rice University. And what he says is that if we look at the global demand for energy, that if we bring everyone up to the same standard of living that we enjoy in the Western world, that we'll need to produce about 60 terawatts of power. And the number right now for global energy demand is somewhere around 15 terawatts. So we can see that the number is large now, but it's going to increase by probably a factor of 4 in the next 50 to 100 years. And furthermore, he said that if we look at the top issues facing civilization and we organize them as shown here on the slide, that if we put energy at the top, that this will give us the resources we need in order to solve many of the other issues on this list. So Professor Smalley is also very famous for winning the Nobel Prize in 1996 for the discovery of fullerenes. And fullerenes are that C60 soccer ball-shaped carbon molecule. And that'll actually play a factor later on in this presentation. So how do we make terawatts of power right now? Well, we use a mixture of non-renewable and renewable resources. If we look at the breakdown between the non-renewables versus renewables, the non-renewable portion comprises about 85 or 86% of how we make our power, and the remaining 14 or 15% comes from renewable resources. So non-renewable resources include things, of course, the fossil fuels, things like oil and coal and natural gas, but it also includes nuclear power because, of course, nuclear reactions use up their fuel, and therefore it's a non-renewable source of energy. And renewable resources include things like making electricity or making power from solar or from sunlight, from wind, from hydroelectric sources, so like a hydroelectric dam that makes electricity, and also from sustainable biomass. So wouldn't it be nice if we could increase the fraction of power that comes from renewable resources? And in this presentation, of course, we're talking about specifically solar power generation. So we have to ask ourselves, if we are going to use sunlight to make electricity and to make power for civilization, is there enough energy available in sunlight in order to satisfy the demands of the world? And so some of the numbers on this slide should convince you that this indeed is the case. So this 1366 number, so 1366 watts per square meter, that's the power density of sunlight striking the Earth's outer atmosphere. If you look at this diagram over here on the right-hand side of the slide, here's the sun out here in space, of course. Then it travels, sunlight will travel through space and strike the Earth. This 1366 actually is on the outer edge of the atmosphere. So that would be in this area right here before the sunlight has been absorbed or passed through the atmosphere. And then if we, after the light passes through the atmosphere, we have this 1,000 watts per square meter, which is the power that's available on the surface of the Earth on a clear day when the sun is directly overhead. But of course, the sun is not directly overhead all day, and there are clouds and so forth. So if we were to average that over a 24-hour period, we get to a number of 300 watts per square meter. So this is the approximate amount of energy available on Earth when it's averaged out over a 24-hour period. And finally, if we consider the surface area of the Earth, we get to this extremely large number, 153,000 terawatts available for harvesting. And we can compare that 153,000 terawatts to the 15 or even 60 terawatts that would be needed for people to use. And we can see, based on this simple calculation, that yes, indeed, there is way more than enough power available from the sun in order to satisfy our demands for electricity and energy. So if we're going to use sunlight to make electricity, we have to be concerned with in what form is that energy striking the Earth. So if we're going to use this light in order to make electricity, we are of course concerned with in what distribution across wavelengths is this energy available to us. So on this graph, we have on the x-axis the wavelength in nanometers, and on the y-axis we have the irradiance, which is expressed in watts per square meter per nanometer of bandwidth in the spectrum. And what we see is that there are peaks and valleys in the solar spectrum, which is the light that is striking the Earth from the sun. And furthermore, we have two traces on two lines on this graph. We have this black line, which is labeled extraterrestrial, and we have the green line, which is labeled at sea level. And we can see that generally the black line is above the green line, and of course that accounts for the fact that in order for the sunlight to strike the surface of the Earth, it has to first pass through the atmosphere, where some amount of the light is absorbed by the components in the atmosphere. And we've labeled on here different absorption peaks that are responsible for absorption over these different wavelength ranges. And if we look here, we see that it's very nice because the peak in the solar spectrum is generally in the visible range, so we have that labeled on here. And then shorter wavelengths in the visible range are the ultraviolet or UV range, and longer wavelengths are called IR or infrared radiation. And then also summarized here is the power density available in these spectra. So we have this 1366 or 1367, which is the solar constant. And then in the standardized AM 1.5G, we have 1,000 watts per square meter of energy density or power density available to us. So if we're going to make a device, make a solar cell that's going to make electricity from sunlight, what are some of the steps that are involved in making this happen? So outlined on this slide are three or four basic steps that are involved in converting the sun's energy into usable electricity. So the first step is absorption of light. So we saw in the previous slide what wavelengths are available to us. Now we need to find materials that are able to absorb those wavelengths of light efficiently. If the wavelengths of light are not absorbed, then we have no chance of making electricity out of those wavelengths of light. Secondly, we have the creation of free charge carriers. These are the electrons, E minus, and the holes, H plus. So these are the actual things in the solar cell that are carrying electricity, the charge carriers. We have to be able to make charge carriers from the absorbed light. And the next step is we have to transport these charge carriers efficiently through the device and harvest them at the electrodes. So the material and the device design we're talking about has to be able to transport the electrons and holes through the thickness of the device. And the final step is now we're able to use the electrical energy that's created by the solar cell, and we could be using the electrical energy maybe to power a device like a calculator or an instrument, or we might be interested in storing the electrical energy so that we can use it at a later time. In that case, we might be storing it in a battery. So these are the three or four basic steps involved in harvesting light and converting it into usable electricity. Oftentimes, when we're talking about solar cells, we talk about something called the power conversion efficiency. This is often abbreviated as PCE. And all this is really is the ratio of the power density that's obtained from the solar cell to the power that's available in the incident light. That is described in this schematic diagram over here on the lower right. So we have sunlight, which is this yellow arrow, shining on the solar cell, and it has some power density available in it. That's the PN. And then here we're looking at maybe a cross-section of a solar cell, just schematically, and the sunlight is shining on the top surface here, and the solar cell is making electricity out of that sunlight. And the solar cell is able to make a certain amount of power out of that sunlight, which is classified as P out. So then to calculate the power conversion efficiency, we simply take the ratio P out divided by PN, and this will generally be a number less than 1. Because, of course, PN is greater than P out. Or if we convert it to a percentage, we multiply it by 100, and we get a percentage in the range of 0 to 100%. Oftentimes, PN, the power density in the incident light, is fixed at 100 milliwatts per square centimeter in the laboratory. This is because we're going to use a solar simulator in the lab, and it's very easy then to calibrate the solar simulator to have a known PN, a known power density, and a very common number then is 100 milliwatts per square centimeter for that PN number. Okay, so now let's look at an overview of the technology and materials associated with organic solar cells. Solar cell technologies are often divided according to generation. So we talk about first generation, second generation, and third generation solar cells. The first generation solar cells are usually the crystalline silicon solar cells. So a classical silicon solar cell with a PN junction, that would be the first generation. Second generation are often called thin film devices or thin film technologies. These include things like amorphous silicon, and alternative semiconductors like cadmium telluride and CIGS. The reason that they're called thin film technologies is because, in general, they require less material than the first generation devices. Less material to absorb the light and to create charge carriers in an efficient manner. So if a first generation solar cell might be hundreds of microns thick, this is dictated by the light absorbing properties of crystalline silicon, as where a second generation device might be on the order of hundreds of nanometers thick, because they would have better light absorbing properties, and therefore you could use a thinner active layer to absorb the light. And then the third generation devices are the organic or polymer solar cells and the so-called dye-sensitized solar cells. And again, primarily in the remainder of this presentation, we'll be focusing on the organic type of solar cells. So let's take a look at this plot, and this helps us to think about what our objectives are in doing organic solar cell research. So we don't have to know what all of these plots are or all these traces are on this graph, but let's look at the blue, the green, and the orange lines. And generally, the blue lines are going to be the first generation devices, the green lines are the second generation, and the orange lines are the third generation. And what we see over here is that, as we would expect, generally, the first generation solar cells are more efficient than the second generation, and the second generation are still more efficient than the third generation. And the whole objective here in research is to bring these orange lines more up into line with the green and blue lines. So there's a lot of research going on right now in order to increase the efficiency of organic solar cells. So first generation solar cell, which are the crystalline silicon solar cells, are often comprised of a PN junction, and the P and the N referring to the type of doping that is present in the silicon material. The P-type material is a hole conductor, and the N-type material is the electron conductor. First generation solar cells have different advantages and disadvantages. One of the disadvantages is that they're made of very high purity silicon, which makes them expensive to process. The principle of operation, which we kind of described previously, is that the silicon absorbs the light to create free charge carriers. These are electrons and holes. And the PN junction then directs the flow only in one direction. And then finally, the charge carriers are collected at the external surfaces or the electrodes that are contacted to the device. This is illustrated schematically on this slide. So in a first generation solar cell, these would be silicon layers. They would have different doping types, N and P type. The N type conducts the electrons towards the top, and the P type conducts the holes towards the bottom. When the charge carriers reach the top and bottom surfaces of the solar cell, they would be collected into these electrodes and transported to an external circuit where they can either be, the electricity can either be stored or it can be used to power a device. Some of the advantages and disadvantages of the first generation type of solar cells, they're highly efficient and they have a long lifetime, maybe on the order of 20 to 25 years. And these are the most common place you would see these kinds of solar cells would be on the rooftops of buildings. So those gray or bluish type of solar cells that are out there, on some installations, those would be the first generation silicon type solar cells. The disadvantages of the first generation type of solar cells is that they're made from expensive materials, very high purity silicon. Therefore, they have very expensive production processes. And since they're made out of silicon, they're generally rigid and fairly fragile. And so the aim of these second and third generation types of devices is stated down here at the bottom of the slide. And the aim, of course, is to address these disadvantages and overcome them by using less expensive materials and less expensive production processes to make efficient solar cells. Okay, so now let's look in a little bit more detail about organic solar cells and how they're structured. So we can see by this diagram on the right-hand side of the slide that organic solar cells are made up of many different layers. In the laboratory, they're often built on a glass substrate. So this is kind of like going in reverse order from top down, actually, is from bottom up when we fabricate the solar cell. On the glass is usually coated a transparent electrode. Often this is a material called ITO, or indium tin oxide. On the ITO electrode is coated a hole transport layer. Next comes the active layer, which is really a blend of two devices in most organic solar cells, and it's a blend of an electron donor and an electron acceptor. We'll talk about that in more detail on the next slide. And then the last layer here is the cathode, which is the electron collecting electrode, and that's usually deposited on top of the active layer. Keep in mind that organic solar cells are sometimes called plastic solar cells because in the active layer, these are often conductive plastics or polymers that are used to make the device. And it's very important to remember that the active layer actually contains a mixture of a donor and an acceptor. And when this is the situation, the device is often referred to as a heterojunction solar cell. Let's take a look at these materials in a little bit more detail. Over here we have an AFM scan of the indium tin oxide electrode. And what we see is that the ITO electrode really is made up of nanometer-sized crystallites, maybe about 40 nanometers in diameter. And these crystallites are arranged into larger domains that are maybe on the order of 400 to 500 nanometers across. So we can see it's a multi-crystalline material, and it's actually quite rough. If you look next at the hole transport layer, that's often a conductive polymer mixture called P.PSS. And the chemical structures are illustrated here of the P.PSS and PSS respectively. When this material arrives in the lab, it's usually delivered as a blue liquid, and the blue liquid is then spin-coated on top of the ITO in order to make a smooth surface that functions as the anode, or the hole-collecting electrode. If you look now at the active layer materials, the most common type of organic solar cell is made up of two materials abbreviated as P3HT, which is the electron donor, and PCBM, which is the electron acceptor. What we're looking at here in this graph is a UV-Vis spectra of the P3HT material. And so what we see is that the P3HT material is very good at absorbing light over this wavelength of maybe about 400 to 600 to 650 nanometers. But beyond about 650 nanometers, it doesn't absorb very much light. And therefore, if it can't absorb the light, then we can't make electricity out of those wavelengths of light that are not absorbed. And so there's a lot of research going on now in order to make organic polymers that absorb light out to longer wavelengths. Because if we can make the polymer absorb more light, then we can make more electricity from it and therefore make a more efficient solar cell. So we can see on this UV-Vis spectrum, one of the limitations of the organic solar cells is that some materials don't absorb light very efficiently. And looking at the soccer ball-shaped molecule, the fullerene derivative, remember this is similar to the molecule that was discovered by Smalley. This is the electron acceptor. And it has this extra group hanging off the side of it, and that extra group simply makes it more soluble in organic solvents. Because, of course, we're going to use spin coating to apply these materials. In order to spin coat something, we have to be able to dissolve it in a solvent and apply it as a liquid to the sample. Okay, so now let's look at the active layer in a little bit more detail. And so now in this diagram, what we've done is we've now turned the device on its edge, and we're looking at a detailed cross-sectional schematic of the active layer only. And so we have our donor and acceptor materials. The donor, which is generally the P3HT, is in white, and the acceptor, the PCBM, is in gray. And in order to make efficient devices, it's very important to have control over the morphology or structure of these two components in the active layer. So control over the spatial arrangement of the P3HT and the PCBM. The reason we need that is because when the P3HT absorbs light, it doesn't immediately create free charge carriers, electrons and holes. It creates an excited state called an exciton. And the excitons can be thought of as a hole and an electron kind of stuck together. They're not free to move around wherever they want to go. In order to dissociate or kind of free up the electrons and holes, the excitons have to dissociate, and the dissociation only happens at the interface between the donor and the acceptor. In addition, the excitons have a limited lifetime and therefore a limited diffusion distance. And it turns out that the exciton diffusion length, or LD, is on the order of nanometers, approximately 10 nanometers. If the excitons do not dissociate into free charge carriers, then that excited state will just relax and we'll have lost that opportunity to make electricity. So therefore, the donor and acceptor materials have to be structured on a nanometer length scale, so on the order of tens of nanometers. So that dictates how big these structures can be in the active layer. So there's a lot of effort that goes on when processing an organic solar cell to ensure that we have this nanometer scale phase separation of the donor and acceptor materials. And the final requirement is that we have to be able to transport the electrons and holes easily to the electrodes. And in order to do that, we have to make sure that the active layer has a bicontinuous structure so that the electrons and holes have clear and conductive pathways to reach the external electrodes. So the anode would be the hole collector. It would be somewhere over here on the left. And the cathode is the electron collector, and it would be somewhere over here on the right. And we need to have clear pathways for the holes and electrons to reach these electrodes. So this summarizes the importance of the active layer morphology. Okay, so now let's look at an example of a processing sequence in order to construct organic solar cells in the laboratory. So lab scale devices are generally small, less than about 1 square centimeter. For example, if we're going to make a device that's 3 millimeters by 3 millimeters square, then the active area is 3 times 3, which is 9 square millimeters, which translates to just 0.09 square centimeters. The reason that researchers often make these small devices is because they're easy to fabricate and handle in the lab. And also, many devices can be made on one substrate. So let's take a look at an example of how devices can be laid out in the laboratory. So here we have a 2-inch by 2-inch square substrate when we started with this, it was ITO on glass. And then the ITO has been patterned and layers have been deposited in order to fabricate 4 independent solar cells on this substrate. And they're labeled 1, 2, 3, and 4. Each one of them has 2 contacts. 2 contacts for device 1, 2 contacts for device 2, and so on. And if you're going to look at an enlargement of device number 1, it looks like what is pictured on the right-hand side of the slide. So we have this anode contact, which is made out of ITO. And we have the cathode contact, which is made out of aluminum. And then the area where these 2 materials overlap is actually the active area of the solar cell. So this is the actual device, the purple, which is the 3 millimeters by 3 millimeters. And how would we construct this arrangement of devices on the substrate? Those processing steps are outlined here. The first step is to pattern the ITO to establish 4 independent contacts, 4 independent anodes on the glass substrate. This is done by photolithography and wet etching. The next step is to clean the ITO. So after photolithography and wet etching, we could imagine there might be some contaminants on the surface, and it'd be very important to clean the ITO before we make a device on top of it. A very common way to clean the ITO is to use an oxygen plasma or a UV ozone cleaner. Both of these supply activated oxygen in order to clean away any organic residues on the ITO surface. After the ITO is cleaned, the whole transport layer, which is the P.PSS, is spin coated on top, and it's then baked maybe for about 10 minutes in an oven. This helps to cure the P.PSS layer and evaporate any water, which is the solvent that's used to disperse the P.PSS material. After baking, the device is spin coated with the active layer, which again is a mixture of P3HT and PCBM. The next step is thermal annealing. This is often done on 150 degrees C hot plate. The purpose of the thermal annealing, and this is very important, the purpose of the thermal annealing is to establish that nanoscale phase separation of the active layer. So this helps to construct the proper morphology in the active layer to make the devices more efficient. Then we evaporate the cathode on top of the active layer. Usually this is a very thin layer of lithium fluoride followed by 100 nanometers of aluminum. Finally, the contacts are cleaned off in order to make electrical contacts with the anode and cathode. And then we can characterize the device, characterize the current voltage characteristics of the device using a solar simulator. Those processing steps are outlined schematically on this slide. Starting with the glass ITO substrate, so the blue is the glass and the yellow or golden is the ITO. We can use photolithography and wet etching to etch away the areas of ITO that we don't want on the glass slide. This is very commonly done in 9-molar HCl, hydrochloric acid. So if the ITO is 200 nanometers thick, if we etch for about 7 or 8 minutes, that's enough to etch away all of the unwanted ITO, leaving behind only the areas that were protected by the photoresist. After cleaning, we can then spin coat the P.PSS layer on top of the patterned ITO. Then spin coat the active layer, the purple layer here, which is really a mixture of P3HT and PCBM. And again, it's very important to thermally anneal that layer after it is spin coated. And then we can evaporate, transferring it to a metal evaporator and using a shadow mask, we can evaporate the cathode on top of the active layer. Again, that's going to be about maybe 1 nanometer or less of lithium fluoride and 100 nanometers of aluminum. Finally, we can clean off the contacts. So cleaning off where the active layer and P-dot covered up the ITO, and we can make contacts to the ITO below, and also contacting the aluminum cathode. And Here it's shown upside down because that's the way it's fabricated, but generally the device would be flipped over and the light, of course, would enter then through the top, and we could characterize the current voltage characteristics of the device. So this slide summarizes the steps that we outlined on the previous slide. Okay, so now let's take a look at how the devices are characterized in a laboratory setting. One of our main figures of merit is this power conversion efficiency, which is the ratio of the power output of the cell to the power input in the form of light. So when we do this characterization, we get voltage here on the x-axis and current or current density on the y-axis. And again, the units here of current density are milliamps per square centimeter. And the units here on the x-axis, of course, are volts. And so what we're looking at now first is this red line, the red trace. And so how this is accomplished is we shine light on the cell, and it's making electricity, and then we sweep the voltage and collect data points along the way. So this line is constructed from a series of JV data points as the voltage is changed. And so on this line, we have some important points. First of all, we have what's called the JSC, or the short circuit current density, which is the maximum current density that's being produced by the device. We also have the VOC, or open circuit voltage. This occurs when no current is flowing through the device, and it's the maximum voltage that can be produced by the organic solar cell. And then if we now look at the power producing capabilities of the device, we now get this blue curve, and that's plotted on the secondary y-axis over here. So that's power density in milliwatts per square centimeter. So each data point on that power curve is calculated by multiplying the J times the V. So J times V gives you power density for a solar cell like this. And in that power curve, there is a maximum, which is called a maximum power point. And that can be then translated to the operating voltage and current produced, which makes the maximum power. So that would be the V and the J at the maximum power point. And we use that data point, the maximum power point, to calculate the efficiency of the device. So some of the device characteristics are summarized also on the slide. So we have a small area, that 3 millimeters by 3 millimeters, again, of the device. So the area is known. We're using a solar simulator that's fixed the PN at 100 milliwatts per square centimeter. The VOC in this case is 0.56 volts. The short circuit current density is 10.47 milliamps per square centimeter. The maximum power point occurs at 0.43 volts and 8.41 milliamps per square centimeter. This leads to a fill factor of 0.62 and a power conversion efficiency of 3.62%, which is very typical for a P3HT PCBM organic solar cell. So this is an example of a solar simulator that's used to characterize devices. It's comprised of a xenon arc lamp, and it has appropriate filters in order to make the spectrum or the light output of the solar simulator match as closely as possible to that AM1.5 spectrum that is output by the sun. Of course, we have to control the input power density, the PN. So usually before devices are characterized, the solar simulator is calibrated in order to establish 100 milliwatts per square centimeter of power output. If we were going to open up the solar simulator, we'd see that there is this arc lamp that is housed in an elliptical mirror, and the elliptical mirror directs the light off a series of mirrors and through some filters in order to shine it down onto the device. So the device generally would be located here in the beam of light that's exiting the solar simulator. Sometimes it's also very important to monitor the temperature of the devices when they're being characterized, because when the devices are sitting this close to the solar simulator, this might be on the order of a few inches, maybe 5 to 5 to 7 centimeters, something like that. When they're that close to it, the devices can heat up over time as they're being characterized due to the light shining on them. And therefore, it might be important to monitor and control the temperature of the device to hold it at a steady state temperature. That can be often accomplished with a Peltier plate. And now let's finish up by discussing briefly some trends for the future for processing of organic solar cells. So of course we said as we were going through this discussion that one of the main driving forces for organic solar cell development and research is that we want to be able to produce solar cells in an efficient and less expensive manner compared to first generation and second generation solar cell devices. So we saw that the organic materials, their conductive polymers and other soluble materials being soluble in suitable solvents, organic solvents, and in some cases water. If we can dissolve them in solutions, then it's possible that we can use alternative processing techniques to make devices. So some of the things that are being considered now are roll-to-roll printing of organic solar cells or inkjet printing of solar cells. In this case, what you'd be doing is formulating the P3HT and PCBM into inks that can be then printed onto a substrate. Maybe it's even a flexible substrate, like a plastic or even paper. And people are also thinking about other techniques such as screen printing, doctor plating, and vacuum-based deposition for these organic materials. And all of these things have been demonstrated by different research groups to be successful. So organic solar cells show a lot of promise, but there are some disadvantages and advantages to this type of technology. Generally, the materials are low cost, and they're also suitable for low cost processing as compared to silicon-based devices. It's also very nice that these polymeric materials, like the PC, like the P3HT, they can be chemically tailored by organic chemistry in order to meet different specifications. So we could tailor the band gap, which is going to affect the light absorbing properties of the material. And we can also tailor the solubility for different solvents. So this is a great advantage for organic materials in that they can be processed and tailored to meet their requirements for the devices. Some disadvantages, of course, are that so far, the organic solar cells are less efficient than other technologies. So the world record right now for organic solar cells is somewhere around 8.1 to 8.3% power conversion efficiency. And that, of course, is far less than the efficiencies demonstrated by first generation and second generation types of solar cells. The long-term stability also needs to be proven out for the organic solar cells. Although it looks promising, there would have to be extensive lifetime testing to figure out exactly how long the organic solar cells will function. So to conclude, solving issues related to energy production, storage, and distribution takes a concerted effort. And there's a lot of effort going on right now, a lot of research going on out there by scientists and engineers who are engaged in alternative energy. And there are plenty of challenges out there that need to be met in order to make efficient solar cells possible in a low-cost manner. And nanotechnology, such as making nanostructured films for organic solar cells, is definitely one way that will make a big impact on the organic solar cell market. So organic solar cells, while they're not as efficient as their silicon counterparts, they do show a lot of promise in being able to make electricity efficiently and inexpensively from sunlight. That concludes this unit on organic solar cells. Thank you for your attention.